Comments made on Serospectives are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotech, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers. Hello and welcome to Serospectives for the month of March. We are, of course, in April, but are discussing those items which made news during the month of March 2013. If you notice a different sound to tonight's Serospectives, that is because we have given our fine regular host, Steve Sozin, the evening off. I am Lisa Salinger, and it is an all-women's edition of tonight's podcast. So we hope that you enjoy it and that you enjoy our guests and the information that they have to share. But first, I'd like to take care of a few things. If you're looking for headphones with a safer open-ear design so that you can talk to others and still hear what's going on around you, then please continue listening, because we are going to have an offer for SPN listeners where they can get 40% off Aftershock's headphones, including the new Bluetooth model that is due out soon. So we will be sharing that code a little later in the show. We invite you to keep listening. If you are listening live, you can go to If you are listening after the show is done, if you are not listening live, you can go to serotalk.com and you will find the code in the show notes as well. We've had some questions about the format, and people say, why do I hear beeps and tones? And you hear those tones when we are showing documents on the screen. If you are listening live, you can look at the websites and the information that we're putting on the screen. Every time you hear a tone, that information changes. If you are listening after the fact, that tone will signal to you that there is a new story, but of course, unless you're looking at the show notes, you won't see the information. The other question that we get is, why doesn't Serospectives sound like the other podcasts? And that is because Serospectives has the distinction of being our only live podcast. So you get to hear background sounds from the presenters who are all over the country sometimes. Sometimes we will insert a comment from the chat. You get the spontaneity of a live format. And we do hope that it is something that you will enjoy. As I said, I'm very happy to welcome our presenters. And the first one of our guests is well known to many of you because she wears many hats. Anna Dresner does writing. She's written a number of publications for National Braille Press. And we will be talking about one of those books a little bit later on this evening. She also provides part-time tech support for BARD, the Braille and Audio Reading Download Service. She homeschools her son and does a children's show on Mushroom FM. When she can, she enjoys squeezing in some time for singing and guitar and flute playing. And as with all of our guests, we have contact information for them so that you can email them or follow them on Twitter. Anna, welcome. We're so happy to have you this evening.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
I do want to clarify that guitar and flute playing and singing, that is not all at once.
Well, the guitar and the singing, yeah. The flute, not so much.
That would be a rare and wonderful talent. If you ever get that one figured out, we'd love to have you back and we'll do a musical Serospectives.
That would be a challenge. I think it starts by needing to grow an extra pair of hands, at least.
I think. Welcome. Next, we have Erin Edgar. She is a lawyer currently working for Legal Aid, which is a nonprofit law firm that assists low-income clients with various issues. She and her husband, Rodney, co-host a podcast called Tech Access Weekly, which focuses on news and events with assistive technology as well as mainstream technology. She also co-hosts the Book Hoarders Anonymous podcast, which is dedicated to book lovers of all persuasions. Welcome, Erin.
Thank you so much, Lisa. It's great to be here.
Yes, Erin is a returning guest, and when we were getting things set up, we realized it had been a year exactly, so we're very happy to have her back. And Anna is new to Sarah Respectives, as is our third guest. Allison Hilliker lives in Tempe, Arizona, and has a bachelor's degree in women's studies from Arizona State University West. She currently works for Benetech, the nonprofit company that runs Bookshare. She's worked there for over 5 years in the collection and development department. When she's not working, Allison does assistive technology related podcasts on the Blind Access Journal website. The site covers a variety of tech topics, but it has a strong focus on iOS devices. Welcome, Allison.
Thank you very much, Lisa. I'm very excited to be on Sarah Spectives.
Excellent. You know, as I was getting things together and organizing all the biographical information, we really could have done a number of themes because all four of us are women. All four of us do podcasting or broadcasting of some kind. And we are all avid book lovers, so I think this will be a great and informative evening. Getting into our tech stories, the first one is kind of a downer. Those of you who are purists, who very much want the focus to be on something that happened in this month versus that month, may be a little unhappy because we do have a positive outcome to report, but it happened in April. But we won't tell if you won't. So Dropbox 2.0 brings functional drop-down menus to Mac and Windows, but accessibility is a little broken. Anyone experience this not-so-usable version of Dropbox?
Well, I just started using it on the Mac, and I have to bring the VoiceOver mouse cursor to it and click on it. But if I do that, I mean, I can't use the normal command for activating it as a menu. But if I use the mouse command, which is very doable, it just kind of have to, you know, just use a slightly different command, it seems to work okay.
Right. Anybody else? I think the Mac users in general had an easier time of this than did Windows.
I don't have any experience with it. I had told my Dropbox not to update itself automatically, so it hadn't updated, and I was hearing so many people say that they were having problems that I made sure that it was not updating, so I'm still using version 1.6 or whatever the latest version was before 2.0. I never updated it.
I had a similar experience.
I heard it was pretty broken.
Yeah, my experience was
similar.
Like both of you. Go ahead, Allison.
Oh, I said I had a similar experience. I read on Twitter. Twitter's very helpful. I love when I get my tech news from other people who try out new software and hardware changes first, and then I've been alerted to potential problems, accessibility and such, in new software and such. So I heard about the problems through Twitter and decided not to update. But I might give it a try if someone tells me it's worth doing at some point.
Well, the latest that I've heard, and I have had the same experiences, that I waited because I heard on Twitter that it was somewhat unusable. And apparently now the latest incarnation of Dropbox apparently still has a small glitch or two, but is mostly fixed. So good news, I think. And for me, the best thing has always been to keep around a copy of the previous version just in case. Speaking of previous versions, we're barely getting into Windows 8, but Windows Blue is being confirmed as Microsoft is starting a yearly update cycle. Thoughts on this one?
Well, I'm always skeptical of anything new that Microsoft tries, because for some reason it just seems like whatever they do in terms of updating, they tout it as a really, really big, pretty, wonderful, brilliant thing, and it ends up really paling in comparison to what they're touting it as. And I have this feeling that they have a big enough problem bringing out a large update every few years and making it go sort of okay. I wonder if they're going to have even more problems bringing out smaller updates each year or so and making sure they all go okay. I always just am very skeptical of their output, you know, their final product. They say it's done, but it always seems like there are a lot of loose ends. And it seems like making smaller, faster updates will give even more of an opportunity for those loose ends to flutter around.
Could be, or it could be that with them making smaller tweaks, they have less invested in it. And so if there's a problem, then you can hope that it would be fixed more quickly. I think whatever they do, it's definitely going to be a very big shift for Microsoft, but they seem to be working toward more of this. You see this with Office 2013 and the fact that they're saying, don't buy the CD, just have it in the cloud and it will change and it will grow. The one nice thing is that it sounds like the price for the next version of Windows will be less, and Apple is using a one-year cycle or a little over 1 year with relative success. Those of you who use the Mac, how are you finding that kind of updating schedule or cycle to work?
I've found it to work okay. It seems like the updates have not broken too many things. And, you know, they're pretty easy to do. It's nice having it cheap. I think that it really does benefit any tech company if they can make their updates fairly cheap, because then more people are likely to update. And then that's easier for tech support people and all of that if there are fewer versions of something in circulation.
I wonder if it might also make the learning curve a bit easier. If there are smaller, more frequent updates, people then are kind of in that learning mode instead of possibly having the mindset of, oh, big scary update, must learn new things.
Oh, yay, I've learned all the new things I'll need to know for 3 or 4 years, so I'll stop being in learn mode, and then 3 or 4 years later roll around and, oh, no, I have to learn all this new stuff again. I do see what you mean, and I agree that if I were going to have an update schedule, if I had to choose, I would choose, you know, smaller updates, you know, closer together. So I think there's a lot to be said for this schedule. I hope that it's something that, you know, Microsoft can pull off. And you know, I think they do need to do something, because they need to do something to continue to make their products appealing. You know, so many people are going from Microsoft to Apple and to, obviously, a lesser extent, Android and other operating systems. So I think this is a good move for them to make their products a little more, you know, appealing, cheaper, easier to update, etc.
Absolutely. Well, from general computing, we turn more toward the web in general and how companies make their products or their sites accessible to those with disabilities. About 2 weeks ago now, Serotech's Mike Calvo had the chance to be a guest on the Wall Street Journal's Lunch Break Live program. And in the show notes, there is a video to that. What you're seeing if you're viewing the presentation live are notes where you can view comments. These will provide an excellent workout while sitting in your chair, because your blood pressure will climb to new heights and you will not have to move. So there certainly is a lot of need for education and advocacy. Erin, I'd like to turn to you first with your legal background. Any thoughts on this program?
Well, in general, I mean, there's no real legal obligation on the part of companies to make their websites accessible to people with disabilities. They're not obligated to, and to some extent, it would be unreasonable to expect certain types of companies to do that. Like, for example, websites that focus on graphic design or, I don't know, internet comics, or I'm just pulling things out of my head about, you know, very graphic-oriented media. At least for those with visual impairments, it would be pretty much impossible to make that kind of site accessible. I think, you know, most of the time, companies don't make sites accessible, and it's not because they don't want to. It's not because they don't really care. It's because they are ignorant about what needs to be done to make the site viewable by, you know, people with various disabilities. And regrettably, a lot of the time, people somehow don't get the, I guess, don't always have the ability to make understood, you know, what needs to be done, and don't always know how to get people, you know, the right people notified about what they need to have happen. And so, you know, I don't think people do it out of malice. I think it's just, you know, accessibility isn't made, and it's a lot of the time due to ignorance. And some people think, oh, it's going to cost me a whole lot of money to do that. And oftentimes, you know, it can be cheaper than what people would have first thought. So other than that, I mean, you know, other than advocacy on the part of people wanting further access, that's the best way, you know, to get things done. And if worse came to worse and no advocacy was producing any results, then, you know, of course you're down to the dreaded lawsuit, which most people don't want, because they often cause more problems than they fix. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Yes. It's not so much a question as just we'd like your thoughts. Allison, Anna, any additional thoughts?
I think that accessibility is abstract to explain to most people who don't have disabilities. I know that for the most part, a lot of people don't know how I can pour orange juice individually. Oh, I'm...
Right. And we also have the concept of... you know, a lot of blind people talk about accessibility, and I've tried lately, you know, it's really just semantics, but it's also a reminder for myself. I've tried to use the term screen reader accessibility because, you know, something can be made accessible to screen readers, but it doesn't mean if there's spoken dialogue, for example, that will be accessible to the deaf. I've just recently learned that certain kinds of flash on websites cause a great deal of difficulty for people with seizures. And they can, the way that a site is set up with strobing lights or flashing things can cause some people to have seizures. So really this is, I think, where we do need universal accessibility and universal design as well.
Right. What I was trying to say, sorry about that, I had some background noise and I had to mute. What I was trying to say is a lot of sighted people don't realize how I can pour orange juice, let alone how I can use my computer. And I find that I try to explain accessibility on the individual level, and I send emails to companies and I make phone calls, but I realize they don't have necessarily the foundational information to respond to my explanations of non-visual accessibility. I still think it's definitely worth doing, and I would definitely never say that it's not something we shouldn't do as individuals, but I'm not sure how effective it is. I'm really not sure that it is. I've had limited success with it, and I know that if I, for example, were to start a social media movement where I would tweet to my friends and say, contact this company with such and such, most of the folks I encounter, especially those who don't have disabilities, would care and make it a priority, but they wouldn't necessarily understand what they need to be explaining to the companies well enough to be able to actually communicate that in an effective way. So that's just kind of my thoughts. I like what AppleVis is doing with their campaign of the month for iOS accessibility. I think that's an interesting concept, and maybe we can see more items like that arising.
Anna, I think go ahead, please.
I think it's always nice when you can actually demonstrate something for people. A couple of years ago, the university where my husband teaches asked me to come in and just kind of go through some of the stuff on their website. And so we just kind of went through different things and how different forms worked. And they could see me getting around some parts of the site and getting information and going to others and having trouble. And, you know, it really, I think, made a difference to some people, especially if they could see that I was successful in some areas. So they could tell that it really was possible for a blind person to do this. But then, oh, gee, this other page isn't working at all. That's a problem. You know, it's not always that easy to do, and certainly not by email. It can be hard to get that across. But it's still good in terms of just letting people know that we're out there and what our needs might be, and that, yes, we can actually do this stuff.
Right. I just think that a lot of times we don't have the opportunity to demonstrate the way our assistive technology works because we can't necessarily go up to a company like Amazon and just say, can I meet up with you tomorrow at the library and show you how my assistive tech works?
Right.
Although I have done that with some people. I have been able to do that with some smaller companies on the more local level, but I'm not sure so much about most companies having access to them.
Now, sometimes, like with voiceover apps, or iOS apps, I mean, the first time I wrote to a developer about an app that was almost but not quite working, the guy was like, oh, what's voiceover? And then got really interested and, you know, within a couple of days had fixed it. And I mean, sometimes you really do run into people that are interested and will do it. And if the project isn't that big, that can be really good. And then the other thing is that some websites, it's kind of interesting to me that some of the ones I have the most trouble with, my sighted husband also finds thoroughly annoying. And so how sometimes just good design is good for accessibility.
Yes, we were talking a few weeks ago in a staff meeting about the ribbons, and I made the comment that the thing that really helped me the most with ribbons, and it's funny because when I get that far, I feel like people are really listening, like, oh, please, what's the great easy tip? And the thing that helped me the most with ribbons, it was understanding that sighted people seem to despise them as much as we do. And
I think that helped me the most too.
It did, because you don't have this feeling of I'm in this alone. It's like we're all grumbling, we're all in this together, and we'll make it, you know. I also would like to point your attention to a blog post that was written as a follow-up to the article called The Court of Public Opinion is Not the Last Resort. We will be continuing with more tech news, but I would like to go ahead and give the announcement that some of you have been waiting for. Aftershocks is pleased to offer a 40% discount on their products to SPN listeners. So if you are listening, whether live or on a download link, or if you usually listen to another podcast altogether, or if you hear about this somehow, you are welcome to take advantage of this. And in the show notes, we have a direct link to the Aftershocks website. The spelling is a little different, and they have a link with products in a way that the products are described a little bit better for screen reader users, and that particular page is laid out a bit better for screen reader users. So they are sort of in a transition as far as that goes, but are making an effort to make it more user-friendly for us. Also in the show notes, you will find a review of the Aftershocks headphones. Jamie Pauls did an interview with Mike Calvo and Buddy Brannon, both of whom had the Aftershocks headphones and still do, I believe, but they had them at the time of the interview. And so you can read the transcript or listen to that. So the code, if you want to order any Aftershocks products, this also includes the Aftershocks Blues, B-L-U-E-Z, I think. They are Bluetooth bone conduction headphones that are shipping soon. You can enter the code SPN40. Now, don't touch that dial yet, as the expression goes. That is capital S, as in Serotech, capital P, as in podcast, capital N, as in network, and the number 40. There is no space or dash between SPN and 40, but SPN must be written in all caps for the program on their site to capture the code and to apply your discount. So what you do is you order your product, you get ready, and when you go to the checkout page, you enter SPN in all caps and the number 40, and the 40% discount will be deducted for you at that time. So thanks very much to Aftershocks and their kind offer to SPN listeners. I think there are many who will be very glad to hear about this. If you're not familiar, these are bone conduction headphones, and they rest basically on your cheeks, so they're not actually in your ears. And because they're not in your ears, per se, you can hear more of your surrounding environment. Some people leave them on while moving around the house or while they're monitoring their children. Some people have them on while they are traveling. That way, if they get a phone call or if they want to listen to music, they can have that at a level that will not interrupt them from hearing the important sounds in their environment that they need. So feel free to take advantage of that and to look at all the neat things that Aftershocks has. Speaking now with of these, neat... Oh, go ahead.
With the bone conduction conducting headphones, I'm wondering if they... I don't know if they're all this way, but my friend has a pair. And one thing to note when you're using these headphones is they enable people around you to hear what you're listening to, which is occasionally not something you want to have happen. So I don't know if that's true of every pair of their headphones, but I do know the Aftershocks one that my friends have, I can hear what's being listened to.
That is correct to a point. That will depend in large part on the volume that they are set at. And that is covered in the review. So if you have further questions or you want to know what these are like or how these work, by all means, check out the review. And you are more than welcome to send us your thoughts either in an iReport or by writing to resources at serotalk.com. I personally would be interested to find out how these work for individuals with cochlear implants, if they are usable, and if there are any complications that they encounter, what kinds of things might that involve. Now, this next one is very interesting, and I'll be interested to know your thoughts on it. There is now a keyboard that basically will rise up from a flat surface. And my question is, now that people are getting used to a touch interface, do you think this is something people would need or want?
I think so.
I'd take it in a heartbeat.
I want to play with it.
I do too. But more to the point, I mean, I like a touch screen, but, you know, as a blind user, I also like tactile feedback. You know, Flexi is great to a point. You know, you don't have to put your fingers exactly on the letters. You know, it's like fancy autocorrect. You know, it'll do it for you. But I like the feel of buttons or keys underneath my finger. It doesn't have to be a, you know, anything big or bulky, just a little dot even would be nice. And so I think that, you know, these keys sound really, really interesting. And like something I would use if I had access to it.
Well, I certainly think the next generation that they were talking about, where there might be all sorts of different possibilities and configurations, I think that sounds especially interesting. I do kind of like the way a flat screen feels at this point, but if there could be markers that popped up in certain situations, I think that would be fun.
I think it'd be interesting to see if they actually do, in fact, make typing faster. It'd be fun to do some research and some experiments with touchscreen versus this new form of raised typing. Because if it's not making things faster, then it wouldn't be worth doing. But I suspect it might make typing faster, and in that case, it would definitely be worth it.
Yeah, I don't know that it would. I remember talking with someone about this when it came out, and I had one of those little laptop-style phones where it flipped open, and there were these tiny little keys. And I found that I was faster, not even using Flexi, just using the regular touchscreen interface. I was faster with that because I didn't have to count all those teeny tiny little keys. So I don't know if raised would help. I did wonder if this technology, though, if the basis of the technology could cross over into Braille displays, because then we could have Braille displays that were, for example, more than one line. Lots of neat possibilities there, I think.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And if you could have like some of the games, like if King Corner actually showed you where the cards were and could actually have at the very least kind of knowing where the card stacks are. I mean, that might require less sort of just feeling around exploring with your fingers. And it might be, I find that game's kind of fun, but tiring. And it seems like if there were actually little tactile marks that popped up, that it might help and make those kind of games more fun.
Yeah, it might be interesting to see a layout of the screen and then have the option to make it go away. Like, when I was trying to learn King's Corner, I thought I wasn't touching in the right places, and I showed it to a friend, and she said, no, it's set up like a diamond. You know, so if you have a tic-tac-toe board, there's a card in the two, the four, the six, and the eight. And the one, and the three, and the seven, and the nine are blank. And so seeing a simple representation of that would probably help. I agree. It's an interesting thought.
Even knowing where they are, it seems like if you could actually feel them. I mean, I know there have been times when I imagine I was probably a quarter inch away from where it actually said what they were. And then it's tiring moving that little bit and trying to get exactly right. And if you had a marking there of some sort, I mean, it would just, it seems like it would have to speed it up and just help a little.
Yeah. I obviously have a short memory, but whichever one of you said, I want to play with it, that was me as well, because I thought, well, you know, I don't know whether it would be good or not, but it would sure be fun to check it out.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Really, we live in such exciting times. We really do. And along with those, we have a piece of information that lets us know that TalkBack version 3.0 is released. Now, I think that all of our group are primarily iPhone, but anybody have any knowledge of or thoughts on this release?
I think Android phones make good paperweights, I've heard.
Ooh.
I've never used one. I'm sure they're probably amazing. I've never used one.
Joe Steinkamp will be emailing you in the morning.
I'm sure he will.
One of our people on this that Android show, not this Android show, it's like This American Life, that Android show. And we also have Triple Click Home, which is our Apple-centric podcast. I think one day we're just all going to give them, we're going to give them plastic swords, and we're just going to kind of battle it out. But the TalkBack 3.0 is released, and some are quite happy with it. And so if you want to hear more about that in particular, we invite you to stay tuned for an upcoming episode of That Android Show. Well, here's one we've been hearing about from various companies in various iterations. Apple announces two-step, I always forget what it's called, two-factor verification. That's the one. Any of you gone ahead and gone through and done this?
I did do it a couple days ago, and it was pretty easy to set up, and I think it's, you know, nicely implemented and nice that it should make it a lot less likely that somebody's password could get changed or that sort of thing without their knowledge. So that's good. I think it's, you know, it's a good idea in a world where there's so many things interconnected. It makes a lot of sense. And it seems like since you only have to do it, since you only have to get a code sent to your phone or something, if you're adding a new device or whatever, I don't think it'll be overly intrusive the rest of the time, which is also good.
They're also not going to have a lot of people around to hold your hand if you lose your, you know, if you lose your activation codes or whatever. I guess I hear they're cutting their staff back a little bit, so they won't have as many people available to help if people lose their, you know, passwords or verification codes. So well, that, I guess, is something to be aware of.
It is. That's true. The good thing is you need to have your, you need to have two of their three things, the 18-digit key, the one of your trusted devices, and I included my phone and also my husband's phone, and that way, you know, if mine were in for repairs, I would still have a way to do it, you know, and your password. So there's three things, and you have to have two of them, and yes, people are going to have to hang on to those and be careful about that. Because apparently they can't reset your password once you've gone to two-factor. I mean, they've set it up that way so that, you know, so you do have to be careful. But at least there are, you know, several different ways of getting it.
To me, it just sounded like too many extra steps and too much of a good thing, too much extra security. I suspect it could be a good idea overall, but I don't know. I also think that I should probably exercise for 30 minutes every day, and I don't do that either. So I kind of equate this with something like that. It might be good for me to do, but it looks like a lot of extra effort and annoyance.
That may be so, but I know for me, I have passwords in my phone. I have contact numbers. I wouldn't want anyone to get. And the thing that really kind of made this indelible impression on my mind was there was one tweet that I saw, and it said, Apple enables two-factor verification. The next tweet I saw was something to the effect of, blind man's iPhone stolen, ripped from his hand. I know of three people that this has happened to. And a lot of my security is in that phone, a lot of my information. It would be just as bad for my security if my laptop were stolen, some such thing like that. So, you know, people have varying opinions on how important it is, and that may have to do with either how much you've stored in your device or how much you've maybe gotten burned. But it's something to keep in mind as an option. I would also encourage you to, I was listening. I was getting a message about a strange audio issue that some of you are hearing who are listening live, and I am not hearing it at all. Okay.
Well, one thing for sure, it's just a really good idea, I think, to passcode your iPhone. I mean, talk about a nuisance. I hate having to type in a password every time I unlock my phone. But at least it's nice to know that if the thing got stolen, it would be pretty tough for them to get at it. And actually, if they try 10 times, everything on the phone gets wiped. And,
yes.
You know, I think that's really important, especially if you're out and about using it, just to kind of know that, you know, to set up something like that so you know that it's really unlikely that someone would get access to all that information.
Right. And if you do the two-factor verification, I would encourage you to not put that code on your computer or on your phone in notes or something, for example, where it will just be neatly synced to the cloud and available for someone to have access to even more of your information. That really is the time and place when you want to use a large print book of some kind, or to put it in Braille, or to record it. So that is something I think that we'll be hearing a lot about from more companies as time goes by. A very hot topic we had last month was the Apple Samsung patent war over VoiceOver, and that has been resolved. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's hard to know how seriously one should take this situation. I mean, these companies obviously are after each other's patents all the time. And there came a point, especially during this last go around with, you know, the patent that's in question, or that was in question this time in Germany, you know, pressing a button, you know, really pressing a button, you know, that was supposedly an infringement on Apple's part, you know, for Samsung. And so, you know, not knowing a whole lot about it, it was hard for me to take this seriously. I mean, you know, they're going after Apple for this? Really? So, you know, it's hard to know whether they had a valid claim or not. But I tend to see all these companies as patent trolls running around after each other, and tend not to really take take this very seriously. And maybe I should. Maybe that's a fault of mine. But I just find the whole thing ridiculous.
No, I agree. And I think the public outcry was such that this is probably a relief to some, but not a newsmaker to many. One thing that is a newsmaker that many have been anxiously awaiting is the new book on iOS 6 from National Braille Press. And Anna has written this book for National Braille Press. It is a little different than the previous books on this subject. Anna, please go ahead and tell us a little bit more about the new book.
All right. Well, it is a supplement to the iOS 5 book. Now, I did include a lot of reference materials, for instance, lists of Braille display and Bluetooth keyboard commands, and a list of all the gestures and all the buttons on the phone and what they do in their various combinations, and lists of resources and such. So if you already know how to use an iPhone and you just want to have a reference book and information about iOS 6, then this book will be fine. But what I did not do was go back through everything from iOS 5, that was in the other book. So if you're a beginner and you want to have something that walks you through the whole process of turning your phone on for the first time and exploring your home screen and dialing the phone, and all of that, then you would need both books, because the changes in iOS 6 just were not great enough to warrant doing a whole new book. So that's what I did, a supplement which can stand on its own as a reference and information about iOS 6. But you know, if you are a beginner, having both would be an advantage.
I really can't speak too highly about these books. They are great. I got the first one when it came out. At that point, I was using an iPod Touch, and I found it still to be extremely helpful. If you're not using an iPhone specifically, I would still very much recommend the book. And you know, I think nowadays we all really want to get our money's worth. And this is just my opinion, but I really do think that you won't be disappointed, because I read stuff and I think, well, that's nice. Okay. And it just kind of sails right on through the brain, you know, like in one ear and out the other. And then maybe I'm looking for just that thing a couple months later, and I'm referring back to the book. I'm using it as a reference. And that one small point that I had a question for, or a question about, I can find the answer. And then, of course, because I need to know it, then it will stick. But it's just a really great reference for the beginning, the intermediate, and even the advanced user, because it shows so nicely how everything is incorporated. Anna, I know you've seen a lot of changes in the device and how it has evolved. I guess I'm just curious, do you have a favorite iOS feature that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, iOS in general?
I'm sorry, iOS 6, my mistake. iOS 6.
Well, let's see. You and I were talking about it the other
day.
That
would be hard.
And you brought up, you brought up the Do Not Disturb feature, which I agree is just invaluable. And then I really think that they went the extra mile on the Maps app. I think it's really neat that you can pick your current location and then choose tracking with headlights down the street. And, you know, it's pretty good about telling you which street you're on and which street's coming up, you know, to get all of that functionality built in and the ability to explore the maps. Most people would not have bothered to try to make the maps actually explorable by touch. It's kind of like the face recognition thing they did last year, where I don't think most people would have gone that extra mile to make that sort of thing work. And I think it's really neat that those features are there.
This is very funny. When I said favorite iOS feature and I didn't specify iOS 6, we had a small explosion in the text chat area, and it sounds a lot like Siri, which undoubtedly has been a benefit.
Oh, yeah, and Siri has gotten so much more stable. I mean, the first few months, it seemed like every time I used it, I had to reset my phone, and half the time it didn't answer, and that's gotten so much better, and now there's so many more things you can do. Just being able to open an app with Siri is such a lovely thing.
I almost committed a grave act of violence the other week. I have over 100 apps on my phone, and I have them organized into folders so that I can locate them easily. And in the folders, to further make locating them easier, they are alphabetized. And somebody said to me the other week, "You don't need all that anymore. You have Siri." And my first reaction was less than charitable. And I'm thinking, I did not do all that work for nothing. Of course, there are times when Siri is not, you know, it's not advisable to use Siri in a meeting. You know, open whatever game app. Sure, that would work. but, you know, my first reaction was, oh, you're kind of right, but yet there really are advantages. And Siri to me is kind of like a reflection of how the whole iOS works, because it has opened up so many new things and there are so many layers to that particular onion, just as there are to the iPhone in general. But truly, these books, I think, are wonderful. And we are very pleased to have you on and to point the books out as a resource to our listeners. Anna was also a guest on the Tech Doctor podcast with Dr. Robert Carter and Allison Hartley, and we have a link to that as well, so you can hear a bit more about Anna's thoughts in putting the book together and all that involved and all that it includes, from something that is very uplifting, we switch to something that is equal parts sad and uplifting. And that is the passing of Mark Marvel. Our sympathies go out to his family and to his loved ones. But really, this man's legacy lives on because he had a wonderful never say die attitude. And I really think that although he has gone from us, his attitude will live on. Do any of you have personal experiences with Mark? Are you? Did any of you know him personally? Well, Joe Steinkamp does and did and has a wonderful tribute to him on the Serotalk podcast that was just released yesterday. He talked about some of Mark's additional challenges. He was saying that Mark could not use touch devices because he didn't have his fingertips. And to be perfectly honest, I kind of teared up when I heard that because I don't have personal knowledge of Mark, but that would be like being blind twice. No braille, no touch devices. That would be very difficult, but Mark had wonderful attitude, had the Blind Ambitions publication. So I strongly encourage you to check out his site. And another item that we have that I think would be something, if I can dare to put words in his mouth, that Mark would have enjoyed, as do so many, because it is a step forward in access. And AFB announces they now have described TV listings, so you can bring up your area and you can find out when the described programming will be on in your area. Have any of you used this?
I have not, not as of yet. I very rarely watch any described TV, and so it really hasn't occurred to me, but I am glad that this list is available and someone has thought to do this because it makes it very easy to find out, you know, where to go to get all of your, or at least some of your assistive or your described TV needs met.
I have not looked at the list, but I can't help but wonder if the process by which one turns on the audio description crack on my TV would actually be accessible. I suspect it wouldn't be.
This is my situation. Yeah, go ahead, Anna.
Oh, just I haven't looked at it either, but it's certainly a great idea.
Yeah, I looked at the actual listings, which was kind of a bad move because I don't watch that much TV, but then it made me kind of jealous.
Want to watch more?
yeah. Well, I want to watch it so that I can watch an hour-long drama and then gripe and say, that would have been a much better book. That was a waste of an hour. But at least it would be an informed waste of an hour. I would have known, you know, that the whodunit person, you know, what they wore and all this stuff. But I have the same situation where my TV is menu-driven. I used to have one of the talking VCRs, and that could be programmed so that you could get the SAP channel. And there used to be independent receivers that got those. So I'm hoping that we'll have some developments in the near future where we can have access to more of that type of thing. However,
I'm definitely going to check. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, because there's really a lot. I was amazed. It's come a long way. However, if you're not watching much TV, described or otherwise, There is no need to fear because there is plenty to listen to, including lots and lots of CSUN coverage from Serotech and others. We released 5 specials containing interviews with various presenters on the CSUN floor. And we also had a special with various people who were at CSUN giving their tech analysis. I know, Allison, that you were at CSUN. You and Daryl got quite a lot of good coverage for your interview with Judy Dixon about the Bard app, and you can find that by going to Blind Access Journal. Aaron or Anna, were either of you at CSUN, or did you have a chance to listen to much of the coverage from it?
Regrettably, no, I wasn't there, but I did listen to a lot of the coverage from, especially a lot of the coverage surrounding Braille displays, since I was in the market for one. And so I did find a lot of the coverage very informative, and was very pleased with a lot of what I heard.
Mm-hmm. I've never been to CSUN. It would be so much fun, I'm sure.
I agree.
But I love the interview with Dixon, and that was really interesting. Very exciting.
I went to CSUN. I think this was my 5th time. I'm very fortunate. I'm able to go with Bookshare and work the booth in the exhibit hall and then also explore the rest of the conference on my own some. And I enjoyed it. And yes, we did do a couple of podcasts on blindaccessjournal.com, including the Bard one. And I really appreciate the folks who talked with us for the podcast. And we even, I just encourage you to visit the website and see what the podcasts are about, but I really do enjoy CSUN conference. So
excellent. Well, that is pretty much about it for this evening. We thank you for coming. We do encourage you, if you have either a SAMNet membership or a 7-day trial, to come in to SAMNet and join us in the Tech Chat room. It is the most fun you will ever have in organized chaos, because sometimes there will be a few conversations going on at once, and some are tech and some are not, and it's just a really great fun hodgepodge. So I would like to thank all of you for coming, our guests in particular. Anna, if you would like to go ahead and go first, followed by Aaron and then Allison, you can give contact information where listeners can be in touch with you.
Well, thanks very much for having me. If you are interested in the books, you can go to www.nbp.org and search for iPhone, and they'll pop right up.
Thanks, excellent. Lisa, for having me on. You can find me. My 2 podcasts are Tech Access Weekly, that's techaccessweekly.com, and Book Hoarders Anonymous is bhapodcast.com. That next one will be recorded soon. We read Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck this month in reaction to Disability Awareness Month, and so I encourage you to check that out if you're at all interested in the whole reading thing. You can find my contact information for those podcasts on those websites.
All right. I'm Allison Hilliker, and thank you very much, Answer Perspectives, for having me on tonight. I really enjoyed this opportunity, so thank you. You can check out my podcasts that I do with Daryl Shandro on blindaccessjournal.com. And we have a variety of different topics and some new material coming soon. So definitely keep checking back often. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm AlliTalk, AlliTalk.
Thank you all very much for joining us. And please don't miss us next month as we discuss all the news for April. In the meantime, if you'd like to keep up with what's going on with Serospectives and get a little bit of tech and how-to and self-improvement and such thrown in for good measure, please feel free to follow us on Twitter. That is at Serospectives, SeroSpectives. And once again, for those who need it, the code for the Aftershocks headphones is all caps, SPN, and the number 40. I'm Lisa Salinger. Thanks so much for listening.